Welcome to the Oldie Podcast. This is from our literary lunch featuring guest speakers and kindly sponsored by Noble Caledonia, specialists in worldwide small ship cruising. Our lunches are held monthly. Details and how to book can be found in our magazine and on the website www.theoldie.co.uk.
Our next speaker is one of our leading historians, Anne Somerset won the Elizabeth Longford Prize for Queen Anne, The Politics of Passion. She's also written about Elizabeth I, William IV, and now with dazzling reviews about Queen Victoria in Queen Victoria and Her Prime Minister's A Personal History. Ladies and gentlemen, Anne Somerset.
Well, thank you very much, Harry, for those kind words. It's wonderful to be talking to you here today. The only thing that's perhaps a bit awkward is that the event is taking place in the National Liberal Club. Well, the club was founded in 1882 by Liberal Prime Minister William Gladstone with the avowed aim of advancing the Liberal cause. Well, that was a cause that was certainly not close to Queen Victoria's heart. As sovereign, she should in theory have been above party. But Gladstone himself said there was no greater Tory in the land. Admittedly, when Victoria came to the throne in 1837, aged 18, she actually was strongly supportive of Lord Melbourne's Whig government, and the Whigs were precursors of the Liberals. But that wasn't really because she espoused a liberal political philosophy. It was more that she simply adored the enchanting Lord Melbourne, gushing that it was such a delight to talk with him and that everyone must love him. And as a result, she was determined Melbourne should remain Prime Minister, even when he no longer commanded a reliable majority in Parliament. In 1839, a Conservative government should have replaced Melbourne's ministry. But the Tory leader, Sir Robert Peel, declined to take office because Victoria flatly refused to substitute any of her ladies-in-waiting with Tory nominees. Over the next 2 years, Melbourne tried to prevent her from becoming completely estranged from the Tories, suggesting, for example, that Victoria invite some leading Conservatives to her wedding to Prince Albert. But Victoria would not hear of it. Of the Tories, she raged. What does she owe them? Nothing but hate. It was only in 1841 that she finally had to accept a Tory government after Melbourne lost an election despite Victoria's having donated £15,000 to the Whigs campaign. Well, for the next 20 years, under Albert's guidance, Victoria did try not to take sides in party quarrels and to give the government of the day the support they required. But unfortunately, when Albert died in 1861, things changed. Overcome with grief, Victoria withdrew into seclusion, and for almost 10 years, she would not appear in public. But she did not renounce her political role, saying that while it was impossible for her to perform mere ceremonials, such as opening Parliament, she would not neglect her other and higher duties. The politicians would understandably have preferred it if she had reversed these priorities. One complained that the Queen held absurdly high notions of the amount of control which she ought to exercise over public business, but they had to put up with the situation. When the Liberal William Gladstone became Prime Minister in 1868, he decided that he must confront Victoria about her continued refusal to perform public duties. And some people credit Gladstone with having saved the monarchy by challenging Victoria in this way. But inevitably, it made for bad relations. As Victoria clashed with him on other political questions, things were already tricky, and matters were made worse by temperamental incompatibility. Victoria found Gladstone wonderfully unsympathetic. She complained he was very harsh and very dictatorial and would listen to no reasoning or argument, as well as being possessed of an overbearing obstinacy and imperiousness that was most disagreeable. So she was overjoyed when in 1874 Gladstone lost an election and was replaced by his Tory rival, Benjamin Disraeli, whom she found infinitely more congenial. Disraeli famously said, "Everyone likes flattery, and when you come to royalty, you should lay it on with a trowel." Well, he certainly observed his own maxim, filling Victoria's life with poetry, romance, and chivalry. Always addressing her in letters as Madam and Most Beloved Sovereign, he proclaimed she was a mistress whom to serve is to love. He praised her judgment unreservedly, saying that her unrivalled experience of public life justified her taking the leading part in the government of your empire. Gladstone would later say, by encouraging Victoria's pretensions, Disraeli had acted as a grand corrupter, and others too felt that under his influence, Victoria became more willful. Victoria herself claimed that Disraeli knew how to get round her. She recalled later, "He had a habit when we differed of saying, 'Dear madam,' so persuasively," but clearly this didn't always work. Disraeli himself confided to a colleague that she could be very troublesome and whimsical, like a spoilt child. Gladstone was now on the back benches, but in 1876, he enraged Victoria by coming out of retirement to attack Disraeli's foreign policy. The Turks had recently carried out dreadful massacres in Bulgaria, and Gladstone thought Britain should join with Russia to punish the Turks for these atrocities. Far from agreeing, when Russia invaded Turkey, Victoria believed that Britain should declare war on Russia. She ranted to Disraeli, "Oh, if the Queen were a man, she would like to go and give those Russians such a beating," repeatedly threatening to abdicate if her wishes were ignored. And it was only with the utmost difficulty that Disraeli avoided war. All this meant that Victoria hated Gladstone more than ever. When Disraeli lost the 1880 election, the Queen was extremely reluctant to take back Gladstone as her Prime Minister. Although she ultimately had to agree to it, their relations over the next 5 years were appalling. Believing the Queen had warped into an imperious despot, Gladstone claimed her mind was now too warped to give judgment on public affairs. He moaned to his wife, "She will never be happy till she has hounded me out of office," wailing to a colleague when afflicted by insomnia, "The Queen alone is enough to kill any man." When Gladstone's second term of office ended in 1885, the Queen fervently hoped he would retire, but she had not seen the back of him. The following year, Gladstone resumed the premiership in hopes of introducing home rule for Ireland. Since this was a policy to which Victoria was viscerally opposed, she believed that she was entitled to do all she could to block it. She now broke the most basic of constitutional rules by forwarding to Lord Salisbury, who had become Conservative leader after Disraeli's death, much of Gladstone's confidential correspondence to her. And she also met secretly with Salisbury to coordinate opposition to Home Rule. To her delight, in July 1886, the Home Rule Bill was defeated and Salisbury became Prime Minister in his turn. But Gladstone had not yet abandoned politics, and in 1892 he became Prime Minister for the fourth time. A disgusted Victoria raged at the prospect of having that dangerous old fanatic thrust down her throat. It was quite ludicrous. It is a bad joke. Showing an almost comical incomprehension of the democratic process, she told her daughter, "It seems to me a defect in our much-famed constitution to have to part with an admirable government like Lord Salisbury's for no question of any importance or any reason, merely on account of the number of votes. Much to her relief, Gladstone once again failed to secure home rule for Ireland, and in 1894 he stood down as Liberal leader. Victoria did not disguise her relief. Her letter after he tendered his resignation was so curt, Gladstone complained his departure from public life had been handled with the same brevity that perhaps prevails in settling a tradesman's bill. Well, I am rather uneasy that in focusing today on Victoria's dealings with Gladstone, I may have done her something of an injustice, for it's only fair to point out that her interventions in politics were often positive. Although she and Gladstone ended by holding each other in mutual detestation, most of her nine other prime ministers had real respect for her views. Well, of course, they often found her difficult, for it was not altogether easy to reason with someone who once remarked, "When she had a strong conviction, she generally found she was right." But while Disraeli's baroque tributes to her sagacity and discernment may have been overblown, they were not devoid of truth. At her death, Lord Salisbury commented on the profound penetration, almost intuition, which she brought to bear on political questions. Another minister observed, "The more you transacted business with her, the more you were astonished at the depth of her knowledge and the acuteness of her judgment." Nor was she a habitual warmonger. Following the outbreak of World War I in 1914, her grandson, Kaiser William II, actually remarked, "If my grandmother had been alive, she would never have allowed it." But having said that, it's undeniable that Victoria was hardly the model constitutional queen that she imagined herself to be.
Thank you so much, and for a wonderful speech, but also a reminder that we are in the great Valhalla of liberalism, and for those who are coming to the next Aldie lunch, the drinks before lunch, you can admire portraits from everyone, from Gladstone to those titans, Paddy Ashdown and Jeremy Thorpe, in the library where we have drinks before.
You have been listening to the Aldie podcast. Please share this episode. Look out for the Aldie magazine subscription offer on our website, www.theoldie.co.uk. Thank you and good luck.